Aquaculture and You, Creating a Sustainable Resource. A production of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. The Roots of a Crisis, Fish, Aquaculture, and the Industrial Revolution. In the previous podcast, we examined the general state of aquaculture before the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. Though many techniques for raising fish had been developed in Europe and the rest of the world, the intensity of these aquacultural practices had leveled off, and aquaculture still played only a minor part in global food production. Rivers and oceans had bountiful quantities of fish, and aquaculture remained a supplementary technique for obtaining a food source that could still be taken from the wild without undue difficulty. But the sweeping changes that shaped the Western world throughout the 1800s would have dramatic consequences for fish as well as for people. As early as 1750, Europeans had begun to experiment with the artificial hatching of salmon and trout. Salmon runs and trout streams had already begun to suffer from the effects of the many dams that would continue to be built on rivers throughout the industrialized world during the next 200 years. Dams and pollution from the mills and factories they powered devastated traditional inland fisheries. Migratory fish could no longer reach their spawning grounds, and the rivers themselves became inhospitable environments for many aquatic organisms. Canals diverted and rechanneled entire waterways, and all the rivers were heavily fished. Scores of streams and rivers on the North American coast lost their Atlantic salmon runs entirely, and others witnessed drastic declines in many species of fish. In Europe, salmon had disappeared from all the largest and most productive rivers by the end of the century. Around 1800, the pressure on fish was intensified by advances in transportation and preservation technologies. The mechanization of ships and equipment led to the depletion of nearshore stocks, but also enabled fishermen to easily reach the middle distance fishing grounds and venture even farther offshore. Machine-made ice allowed them to preserve the fish for the trip back, and new railroad networks enabled the fish to be shipped long distances once they were landed in port. Between 1850 and 1900, fishing fleets gradually converted to steam power, mechanical winches, and high-capacity otter trowels. These more powerful and efficient ships and technologies provided larger catches to supply increasing demand from the expanding citizenries of Europe and North America. By the end of the 19th century, industrialized fishing fleets bringing fish in from the high seas had almost completely supplanted the traditional fisheries of coasts and estuaries that had formerly been adequate to meet the needs of the population. Without any controls on harvesting, all the fishing banks on the continental shelves on both sides of the Atlantic were heavily exploited. Fortunately, while this expansion of the fishing industry was taking place, there was also a parallel rise in awareness of fish stocks as a valuable resource. And by mid-century, governmental commissions and scientific societies began to press for fishing regulations and specialized study of sea fisheries. Even in the 19th century, fishermen and scientists were noticing declines in catches and size of fish. All this led to the development of marine science, and in particular, fisheries biology. Responding to these declining sea harvests, one of the first activities of fishery scientists was the artificial fertilization and rearing of fish in order to replenish the diminishing numbers of wild fish. One of the first to write a detailed method for successfully breeding trout was a German officer and naturalist named Ludwig Jacobi. In 1763, he published an article that described his technique for using an incubator box set in gently flowing stream water to hatch fertilized eggs. He meticulously noted water temperatures and incubation times, and explained how to raise the fry in separate ponds of clean water. As interest in boosting wild stocks increased in the following decades, his work was translated and used as the basis for experiments in several other countries where work was concurrently being done. There are reports of other independent attempts to breed trout in the early 1800s from Italy, Scotland, and even Bohemia, where the fish farmers were watching their fish ponds rapidly being converted into pasture land to raise livestock. The first scientific papers on hatching trout appeared during the 1840s in France, and a slew of publications followed. Most notable were those by Professor Victor Coste, a member of the French Academy of Sciences who worked at the College of France. Coste also wrote about culturing eels, another migratory species that was in decline, and culturing oysters as well. Europeans had been enhancing oyster catches since Roman times by transplanting them into waters where they would grow faster. Coste refined existing methods for collecting and raising young oysters, called spat, in order to revitalize the oyster industry in France, which was in rapid decline due to pollution and over-harvesting. His recommendations worked. Coste became the savior of the French oyster industry and a sought-after expert on fish culturing. In 1852, with the backing of the French government, Victor Coste founded the first fish hatchery. Located in northeastern France, this hatchery would send fish eggs to rivers throughout Europe and would raise multiple fish species, including salmon, trout, char, herring, and even sturgeon. An impressive and expensive facility, the French fish hatchery inspired visitors from other countries to build their own hatcheries. Enthusiasm for fish stocking spread, and government-funded hatcheries began to spring up all over Europe. In Great Britain in 1861, Frank Buckland had managed to raise river perch, and his subsequent book on fish hatching and his continued research on pisciculture led to him being appointed National Inspector of Salmon Fisheries. Buckland became the foremost authority on fisheries management in England and helped secure the passage of several laws protecting salmon. Buckland was also deeply concerned about the wasteful practices of the new fleets and the impact they would have on future fisheries.
How are we to devise a mesh of net that shall let go the small soles and undersized fry of other fish, keeping the marketable fish only, allowing the others to escape and grow?
Meanwhile, back on the continent, new scientific techniques to analyze water purity and soil chemistry were being used in order to increase productivity and revitalize traditional fish farming enterprises there. But for Europe, the game changer arrived in the 1880s. Rainbow trout eggs began to be imported from the United States, and many countries vigorously stocked their lakes and rivers with the popular sport fish. Rainbow trout, along with other salmonid species such as brook trout, brown trout, shad, and salmon, would become some of the most widely dispersed hatched fish in history. Americans and Canadians had been experimenting with breeding salmonids since the early 1800s. Their large eggs and ready availability, as well as their popularity as game fish and on the table, made them an obvious choice for pioneer fish culturists. By the 1860s, commercial hatcheries had been established. In 1867, Samuel Wilmot started a production hatchery for salmon in Ontario, and America's first salmon hatchery, modeled after the Canadians, was founded in Maine in 1870. In 1864, Seth Green began producing shad at a hatchery in Caledonia Springs in New York. Green shipped 12,000 shad fry to California in 1871, where they swiftly multiplied and created a new Pacific Ocean fish stock. American shad and salmon runs on the East Coast were already in serious decline at this point. In response, in 1871, the U.S. Fish Commission was formed to determine the reasons for the serious decrease of commercial fish and aquatic animals in coastal and inland waters, and to help initiate restoration efforts. This commission would later evolve into the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries in 1902. The prime directive for the new commission was to increase fish populations, and they turned to fish hatching with evangelical zeal. Fish hatcheries sprouted up everywhere, and fish eggs and fry were sent in all directions of the compass. Starting with the Baird Hatchery on the McLeod River in Northern California in 1872, salmon culturing spread up the coast, with Washington State alone eventually claiming 14 hatcheries by 1900. Well before any troubling concepts of invasive species and native ecosystems, salmon and trout were sent to Europe, Japan, New Zealand, and South America, and rivers and lakes across North America were aggressively stocked with multiple species. This accounts for the wide variety of non-native fish you can see today in many inland waters of the United States. Bass and catfish were also transplanted, and this is when carp were brought to America as well. American hatcheries can be understood as a first response to the heavy toll that dams, pollution, and overfishing were taking on native freshwater fish stocks in America, even before the turn of the 19th century. The U.S. government also helped support efforts at marine fish culturing, with the first marine hatchery being built at Woods Hole in Massachusetts in 1855, in effect founding what would later evolve into the world's first marine science laboratory and research complex. This was initially successful, and a second hatchery at Gloucester Harbor was built, where cod and lobster were produced. An event of great significance for aquaculture today occurred in England in 1883. Marine and freshwater scientists from 31 nations converged on London for the International Fishery Exhibition. Even at this early juncture, concerned people were debating whether oceanic fish stocks could continue their seemingly boundless abundance. Thomas Henry Huxley, the grandfather of English biology, and by then the president of the Royal Society, gave the inaugural address. He devoted a great part of it to the question of whether there should be any regulation of fisheries at all.
I believe then that the cod fishery, the herring fishery, the pilchard fishery, the mackerel fishery, and probably all the great sea fisheries are inexhaustible. That is to say that nothing we do seriously affects the number of fish, and any attempt to regulate these fisheries seems consequently, from the nature of the case, to be useless.
Most of the younger generation of scientists in attendance, aware of the new fishing technologies and their expanding use, did not share Huxley's confidence. Inspired by the American marine and freshwater hatchery successes, these scientists returned to their countries with plans for hatcheries of their own, supplies of fish eggs, and most importantly, a determination to begin the systematic study of the seas. Many countries' marine science programs were initiated in the years following the exhibition of 1883. And after 1900, when the worldwide enthusiasm for fish hatcheries had somewhat abated, many hatcheries that had been started in the wake of the exhibition were converted into marine science laboratories. In the first half of the 20th century, however, with two notable exceptions, worldwide aquaculture for the most part languished. The world's population was still less than 2 billion in 1900 and hadn't reached 3 billion in 1950. The industrialized fishing fleets supplied plentiful numbers of inexpensive fish and shellfish. There was no incentive for investing in fish farming in most countries. One exception was Japan, where eel, oyster, and seaweed production became priorities of the rapidly industrializing nation. The big exception for aquaculture, though, was the United States. The many salmon hatcheries on the West Coast had played a major role in mitigating the damage inflicted on salmon runs by dam construction, though throughout the century, dams continued to be built that had negative impacts on salmon runs. Recognizing this, in 1920, the Federal Power Act was passed, requiring all private power projects to install fishways. Additionally, the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Act of 1934 would require federal water projects to provide protection and compensation for affected salmon fisheries. This channeled significant funding into technical and scientific research on the biology and propagation of the five types of Pacific salmon. By the way, in case you've ever been confused about that number, it's probably because each species is referred to by at least two different names. They're the same fish, though, and in order of how rich they're considered to taste, they are king or Chinook salmon, sockeye or red salmon, coho or silver salmon, pink or humpback salmon, and finally chum or dog salmon. Though last on the list, chum salmon provides the best salmon roe for ikura that sushi aficionados love. The various terms are either descriptive of color or other physical characteristics, king being the largest strain, or they are derived from indigenous names for the fish.
Chum takes the prize for being both, as it's a Chinook jargon word meaning mottled or spotted. In any case, American expertise regarding Pacific salmon that accumulated during the first part of the 20th century would be foundational for the extensive marine aquaculture operations based on salmon that would come later in the century. Ultimately, over 80 mitigation hatching facilities were built in the Pacific Northwest, which released billions of juvenile fish to supplement the wild fisheries. At the same time, in the southern U.S., the need for economic revitalization spurred interest in establishing farm ponds for raising freshwater fish. An experimental station was begun by Homer Swingle at the Alabama Polytechnic Institute in 1934 to research methods of fish pond management and aquacultural production. They actively promoted new ways to raise catfish and other species to local farmers. And by mid-century, there was an estimated 1.7 million farm ponds across the United States. Alabama Polytechnic eventually grew into Auburn University, and the research begun by Swingle and his colleagues expanded into a tremendous knowledge base for the freshwater fish farming industry. Catfish raising is now a major economic resource for many southern states, and Auburn is one of the top institutions for the study of aquaculture in the world today. But despite the depredations of two world wars, worldwide influenza epidemics, and numerous other calamities, the number of people inhabiting the world continued to increase. After the Second World War, human populations skyrocketed, and the fish catches escalated as well, intensifying the pressure on fisheries. Many fish species had had an unexpected reprieve during the 6 years of World War II, when their seas became contested areas. Fishermen had stayed ashore and fish numbers rebounded. But with the spiraling demand for food looming in the post-war period, these stocks of fish could not be counted on to last. Already in the United States, the sardine industry off the California coast had crashed in the 1940s, a fishery that had comprised 25% of the total U.S. seafood catch. Though now thought to be a combination of overfishing and natural boom-bust population cycles, the sardines have returned in the 21st century, and you can probably find them in your local supermarket. The sardine crash removed from the market a fish that had been a staple feature of American lunches in the 1930s. And with fleets of diesel-powered factory fishing ships equipped with sonar taking to the seas in the 1950s and 1960s, crashes in fish populations would start becoming more frequent. All the chance had been taken out of fishing. If ocean fish were to survive, nothing less than a blue revolution was necessary. And that revolution will be the topic of the next podcast. But before we move on, all this history of fisheries offers two valuable takeaways. In 1940, Englishman Michael Graham wrote a charming little book called The Fish Gate, in which he described the development of the British fishing industry up to his time. He includes at the end an extract from a report to the Fishing Commission from 1883. It is alleged that although there may be an increase in the total amount of fish brought to market, the takes of each boat are smaller, in spite of improved fishing gear, and that fish are really scarcer than formerly. To decide what amount of truth there is in this view of the case is, in our present state of knowledge, impossible. Graham goes on to give similar stories backed by records for the ensuing decades up through the 1930s. He was firmly of the opinion that the seas around England were being overfished, and he formulated what he called the Great Law of Fishing. It had two parts. One, fisheries that are unlimited become unprofitable. In other words, more and more boats chase fewer and smaller fish farther and farther from shore, creating a downward spiral of more work and less reward. And therefore, two, limiting the effort will restore profit to a fishery. In Graham's time, fishery management was a pioneering concept, and regulations have not come in time to save many of today's fisheries. People can be quick to debate the facts, but slow to change their ways. The wider net meshes Buckland had wished for in 1860 didn't become law until the 1930s, for example.
And meanwhile, the ocean fisheries have been hit hard for over 100 years now. This is why sustainable freshwater aquaculture, with its ability to take the pressure off wild stocks, offers such hope for the future, as it can help make wild fisheries sustainable as well, by allowing limited ocean fisheries a chance to recuperate and stabilize. Okay, on to the Blue Revolution, and thanks for listening. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, 2012.